Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On the programme today, we'll be talking to Annu Partanen, the Finnish-American journalist whose book The Nordic Theory of Everything tries to explain the best bits of the region to the rest of the world.
We'll also be hearing from Lola Odejinran, the pilot whose dream to fly a light plane solo around the world saw him taking the long way around.
And we'll be talking climbing with Jim Harrington, the photographer whose new book captures the likeness of some of the world's most high-minded athletes.
That is all to come, plus Henry Rees-Sheridan will be here with next week's news and we'll play some great music too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Rob. Good to be back with you here on our Sunday lunchtime weekly catch-up.
It's nice to be in the saddle. How are you feeling today? A little saddle sore maybe after another busy week?
Yeah, I've been ailing. I'll be honest with you, Rob. The last couple of weeks, I've had a very persistent cold. But I'm hoping to clear the literal and metaphorical cobwebs, blow them away, and be in fine fettle for the rest of the programme.
Some things do need a health warning, don't they?
Maybe we should sound some kind of klaxon to alert listeners.
It's in inverted commas, Henry Rees-Sheridan. Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock. All right, Henry, oh Henry, love the way Texas hop.
But how am I doing now? Everything is all right.
Hi, Henry.
Hi, Rob.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. How's it going?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Tom.
Happy to see me also.
Well, you're there. A little bit of an Antipodes special today on the news look ahead, beginning with one of the Citizenship Seven. Who are the Citizenship Seven? You know, Tom, surely.
Of course, Henry, but why don't you explain?
They are the seven Australian politicians who came a cropper of the country's, some would say absurd, dual citizenship ban. Hmm. Politicians serving in their parliament. On the 2nd of December, Barnaby Joyce is going to stand in a by-election that was triggered when it was discovered that he had New Zealand citizenship. Now, he's expected to win that competition, but I just thought it would be interesting to use it as a hook to talk about this law in general. They are looking, I think, at reforming it. But it did come as a shock, didn't it, when these kind of heads started to roll as a result.
I just don't see... Hang on, can I see the logic?
Can I just backtrack here? I might not be picking up what you're putting down here. So if you are an Australian Member of Parliament, you're not allowed to have another passport in your armoury.
You cannot have any...
You cannot be a dual national.
Any other country.
If you're Australian at all.
To serve in Parliament.
Oh, okay.
But some of these people who've lost their jobs... literally discovered they had that, i.e. grandmother applied for an Italian passport because out of some old loyalty and fondness for the old country.
This has completely passed me by. That's bananas.
It's absolutely...
Fiona Nash from the Nationals, her dad was born in Scotland. That was the only crime she committed. And she's out of a job. It's phenomenal.
Wow.
And there were seven people, I think two of them, they were allowed to stay. One of them, Nick Xenophon, was because his dad was from Cyprus. They left Cyprus after it had become independent, but he still had like a weird British protectorate pink slip.
To sort of play devil's advocate, obviously the point here is that your loyalty can't be questioned if you're not sort of beholden in any way to another state. And on one level, I can kind of see where that comes from. You go back to, say, times of war, when you would say, well, you know, can a German national living in the UK, can we rely upon them? Mm. I mean, it's a bit of a stretch, even in such turbulent times. But the idea that now, in a country, this is the key rub here, that's entirely built, more or less, on...
Absolutely.
Immigrants.
I think also relatively recent immigrants. I mean, you could say that of any country, you know, most countries, if you trace people back far enough, and that's frequently, you know, something that people who support migration say. But with Australia, I mean, it has to be, I think...
Modern Australia.
It came out during this scandal when it was at its peak that I think fully over half of the population are actual dual nationals. In a democracy, the parliament is meant to be a reflection of the population.
Yeah.
And this,
well, they should want 50% of their representatives to be exactly that.
This is almost actively prohibiting that from being the case.
Furious political debate on the Monocle Weekly.
If you thought that that was getting Tom Edwards excited, wait till I move on to my next item. So, as you know, Last week, the Australian postal vote about gay marriage happened. 61.6% of people voted yes, that marriage should be equal. Now they're going to begin actually putting it into legislation, the popular will. The debate is going to begin on the 27th of November, tomorrow. Now, there is still some, obviously, ironing out of details that needs to go on here. Amendments probably will be made to this bill. It won't just be straightforward. As is usually the case, most of the kind of headline-grabbing amendments that have been requested, debated, are to do with, can bakers opt out of creating a cake that has two grooms on the top of it? And there's obviously a debate to be had there. But there are also, even for staunch advocates of marriage equality, there are serious questions as to what the specific letter of the bill should be when it's passed. So there are some countries, I think in New Zealand, you know, charities have been delisted and lost their charitable status because of their traditionalist view of marriage since that country legalised gay marriage. There are serious questions of protections of religious freedom here. It could still be a complex process.
It's an interesting thing to watch. And Australia's funny, you know, in both of the respects you've talked about there, Henry. It's kind of weirdly regressive and progressive at the same time.
It hasn't quite got the middle. I mean, in these two instances, at least, we can say that it doesn't seem to have got that middle ground, right? It doesn't hasn't got that pragmatic thing.
Yeah, it's astonishing to me that it didn't have legal gay marriage. When you consider how free and open and progressive, you know, if you go to Australian cities, you couldn't believe that that isn't the case.
The way in which it went about eventually getting it, well, it hasn't got it yet, but it probably will. It did, as a kind of developed Western nation, it did draw attention to itself in quite an odd way, didn't it? Hopefully that chapter will be coming to an end with a satisfactory resolution for most parties concerned. The next topic will probably get you more riled up even than the last two. It's not to do with Australia. Today, the 26th of November, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland will host its Beatbox Championships.
Oh.
I don't know about the details of any of the events, but I do want to debate beatboxing in general. Thoughts, Tom?
One of my measures for whether something is an appropriate activity or not, mute video coverage of it and then watch it for a couple of minutes with no sound. If you watch pro beatboxers doing pro beatboxing with no sound, yeah, it looks pretty silly.
And then what about the other way around? If you hear it on the radio, for example, and you think, hang on,
you might not even know it was beatboxing.
This is the opening bars of whatever, some, you know, classic song.
That is an interesting
point. If it was done by beatboxers, and you're like, wow, I thought that was the full.
So listen to the coverage, don't watch it.
I like that. Resolved. Thanks, guys.
Henry Rhys Sheridan, thank you very much.
Finnish journalist Anu Partanen is now a naturalised American citizen. But when she first moved to the US back in 2008, she couldn't help but notice that nearly everything, from filling out tax returns to education and childcare, seemed, well, a lot more difficult than back home.
It led her to look at some of the best qualities of the Nordic region's famously reliable welfare system and ask, could it work in the States? The resulting book is The Nordic Theory of Everything, and it's been praised for its intelligent coupling of Nordic pragmatism and the American dream.
And she joins us, I'm happy to say, on the line from New York City now to talk all about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, and it's great to speak with you. Let me just ask you, first of all, about this idea of the kind of, you know, Nordic theories of everything, because we hear more and more about, oh, well, you know, the Nordics, they've really got it cracked. Why do you think people are so sort of wedded to that idea? What is it when we look, especially from without, that draws us to this idea that, frankly, in Northern Europe, they know what they're doing?
Well, if you look at different countries today, almost anecdotally, you can travel to a Nordic country or look at how people live there, and they work very well. They're just societies right now, the time that we're living in, the way we're living with the job market or the kinds of jobs we need to do or the kinds of education we need to have, the kinds of family lives we want to live in many Western countries, the Nordic countries have sort of managed to create a system that seems to respond very well to our demands or wishes today. But on top of that, this during the past maybe 10, 20 years, there's been this sort of a cottage industry of research and studies comparing different countries. It has sort of popped up, and all of a sudden there's all these studies that look at education or healthcare or happiness or well-being, whatnot, in different countries. And in those studies, the Nordic countries always do really well. So there's both, I think, this sort of a more anecdotal side to it, but also just this bunch of research that has come out that has said that, well, they're doing very well, really.
Congratulations on that. I wonder, most books come from kind of a moment, most books such as yours that offer advice and a critique also of the new place in which they find themselves, Anu. There's a kind of a straw that breaks the camel's back moment, isn't there? Were you in line at the doctor's surgery, or were you kind of queuing to buy a subway ticket, or was there a moment at which you thought, this is ridiculous, nothing works here? Was there something that is kind of a motif of the tough time that you had relocating to the United States?
Well, I think at first for me it was confusion, and I think anybody who's an immigrant can relate to that. You move to another country, you don't know how anything works, everything seems difficult. So for me it was many things. It was just getting a mobile phone seemed very difficult. Just understanding how to get a credit card and what the credit card interest rates were like, and all these sort of daily things that should be small. Or when I was living in a Nordic country, I thought these were just small, easy things to do. All of a sudden seemed very complicated. But at first I thought it was just me. But I think the moment when I really realized that, oh, it's not just me, it's something actually about the United States, was when I started looking into healthcare. And American healthcare is extremely strange by world standards. No other country really does it the way it does. It's complicated, relies on private health insurance, private companies, employers are involved. It's kind of a mess. And first, when I started trying to buy health insurance for myself, I was at first baffled that this is so complicated. I don't understand anything. Finally, when the insurance company would send me a booklet saying what is covered, it's like this thick booklet with a lot of small print. And then I started asking around my friends and people, like, so I'm having a really tough time understanding how to buy health insurance. And when I buy it, what does it cover? What do I have to pay? What do they pay? Is my cancer care going to be covered? How do you deal with this? And then people, American people that I asked, they were like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what's in my health insurance. There's no way to know. I just get something and I hope it's okay. And so that's when I kind of realized that, oh, okay, it's not just me. It's really that the American system is extremely complicated compared to the Nordic system.
And is there a problem here, I guess? And it's interesting to reflect on. I remember there was a comment that Ed Miliband made a few years ago where he said, if you want the American dream, go to Finland. That you end up researching, putting pen to paper, and you write a book which is essentially a primer to reverse the decision that you've just made to relocate somewhere like the US. Is there a sort of an irony in, I don't know, that runs throughout the book in a way?
I mean, for me, I moved to the United States for a very, in a way, typical reason. I met an American man and we dated long distance 2 years and tried to figure out what to do. Would he move to Finland? Would I move to the United States? And it wasn't an easy decision to make, but eventually, for many reasons, work reasons, we decided I would move to the US, and he lived in New York City, so everybody in Europe loves New York City. So, of course, I thought this was going to be exciting. And it was certainly ironic that after I arrived, I was having such a tough time, and I started reading all these studies coming out saying that, oh, I actually left behind the best well-functioning society in the world and moved to one that I think many would argue is sort of backsliding. The United States used to be the country that really led the world in quality of life and wealth and middle class or whatnot. But today, as anyone can see, if you look at the last elections or Donald Trump support or Bernie Sanders support, a lot of Americans are really upset with the way their country doesn't seem to really do as well anymore. And compared to other countries, it's not necessarily the leader in quality of life anymore. So it is very ironic that I'm still here.
One thing that struck me, Anu, in some of the press materials that we received with your book were sentences like, this book debunks some of the most common myths about Nordic societies. And that's from an American perspective, as in these are negative things. Whereas I think in Europe, we kind of have the feeling that that Nordic societies have a lot of good things going about them. About these are things from which we can learn, rather than like, oh, look at these people paying that, you know, paying up to their neck in taxes and all the rest of it. Was that kind of a very basic, weird thing to come to terms with in terms of even writing and pitching your book to American publishers, that they were dealing with something positive here rather than having to get over what they perceived as a negative?
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the big sort of surprises for me when I moved to the US, to realize that many Americans really see the Nordic system as something horrible. Like, they would throw around these words like, oh, are we supposed to be like Sweden? As if that was like a horrible thing. And I'm sitting there like, well, Sweden's great. What's wrong with Sweden? But it's just American thinking for so long has been so different and opposite, and anything to do with government for many Americans is just something terrible and horrible. So yes, when I started writing the book, I think first thing I really had to do as an immigrant to the United States was try to understand what is the American thinking? What are they thinking when they hear Sweden? And Americans think, oh, 70% income tax. That's what they think. And they think, oh, no freedom, no entrepreneurs, no innovation, no... This is what many Americans think, that it's like the Soviet Union, really. And so first thing as an immigrant to America who wants to write about Nordic countries was that you really have to debunk some of those myths, like, okay, nobody's paying 70% in income taxes in a Nordic country today.
It's a funny thing, and also, you're a Finnish journalist, Anu. You are not Scandinavian, you're Nordic, I suppose. We can make that specificity as well. Do you feel that you've sold it as the Nordic theory of everything because you're bunching some of those countries together, but do you feel that some of your Finnish exceptionism gets lost in this debate as well, that people are very eager to bunch those countries together and just go, oh, it's a bit snowy, la la la, you know, kind of go for the kind of classic tropes?
No, it is true. I think... within Nordic countries, if you ask a Swede or a Dane or Norwegian or a Finn, they will of course say that there's enormous differences between these countries, because we all think we're different from the neighbor or whatnot. Mm. But on the other hand, now that I live in the United States and I look at those countries, I can certainly see why Americans think that they're all alike. And in many meaningful ways, I think they are alike. They have very similar societies, you know, a little bit variation, but when you talk about policies like parental leaves or affordable daycare or healthcare, they're very similar. So I guess it depends what are you focusing on and how close you are to whatever you're talking about, whether the differences are really big and significant or whether actually it's totally fair enough to talk about them as like one big area.
And if we ask about, look, the book is subtitled In Search of a Better Life, and we don't want to reveal the ultimate secrets and conclusions, because, of course, people should buy your excellent instructional book. But just on the point, you know, is there kind of one thing that helps to explain these sort of inclusive Nordic theories of everything? I mean, is it the fact that it strikes me immediately, you know, it's a cooler part of the world? Does the blood run cooler? People less prone to being rash? You know, is that one of the reasons? Is there something that, in a nutshell, sums it up? Or is part of the process this idea that actually you can't answer questions of this complexity with a one-liner?
Oh, dear. I think if you ask other Nordics, they think that Finns, while being very cool and quiet and maybe monotone in their expressions, are also the ones who will bring a knife to a wedding and be drunk and fight and stuff. So I don't know how cool and collected they would consider Finns to be. But yeah, of course it's difficult. I think often in America, certainly, there's this tendency to go for the cultural explanation. And for me, it's like, I really believe that people in many ways are similar in all countries. They all want what's good for their children. Most people want to work. They want to be respected in a society. You know, there's cultural differences, but when it comes to creating a well-functioning society, in many ways people want the same things. So I think for me, the Nordic countries have just created these policies that seem to work very well today. Although one big myth about cultural thinking that I think I discuss in the book, and that's at the heart of my view of the Nordic nations, is that Americans, and I think people in many other countries, tend to think that Nordics are these collectivist people, that they just are altruistic. They think of the good of the whole country rather than just their own self-interest. And I don't think that's at all true. In that too, I think that Nordics are just like everyone else, very interested in their self-interest. It can be altruistic, sure, but that's not the motivation. And I think the biggest misunderstanding of the Nordic model, if you will, is that it's an altruistic model. It's not. People go with it because it really helps themselves. Everybody, you know, pays taxes, gets services, gets a good life. I think people are in it for selfish reasons, for their own independence and their own freedom and their own quality of life. And so if you talk about culture, I think it's a misunderstanding to think that Nordics are very collectivist. In fact, in many ways, they are quite, they really value their independence. And this system really gives you that.
And just finally, maybe, Anu, one of the great things about your book is that it's done a very un-Nordic thing, which is to kind of kicked up a bit of a fuss as well. It's been very well reviewed by the New York Times, by all the people that you would want to have a quote on the front of your book, of course. But it's also, you know, pissed some people off, as it should do when it's trying to suggest another way of the largest country or a very important country to change the way it lives. Has that been kind of an instructive thing as well, how you handle that, how you get into a bit of a scrap with other journalists and other thinkers?
Yeah, that was certainly something to be expected. I mean, none of us are too keen on having someone from the outside come in and criticize the way we do things. That's obvious. We don't like that. And I think Americans in particular, many Americans have the view that the United States is very exceptional. It's a country that cannot be compared to any other country in the world, that the U.S. has its own ways of doing things. And if you don't like it, get out. And sure, fair enough. If you think that the United States today works very well, but we can see that a lot of Americans, I think that the United States today does not work very well. So, you know, you might want to look at some new ideas or different ideas. For me as a writer, I really wrote the book. I wanted it to start a conversation, and I've been really happy that I think that's what it has done. I mean, actually, most of the attention that I have gotten in the U.S. has been rather positive. That has been wonderful. But yes, certainly there have been some more conservative-minded or libertarian-minded people who were not so into the ideas. Completely fair. It's all to be discussed.
I'm glad you ended on that. That sounded like the very reason, the very rationale that is at the heart of the Nordic theory of everything. Anu Partinen, thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to keep things a little Nordic now with a helping hand from Canada. This is new from the Swedish record producers Patrick Berger and Marcus Krunegard, featuring the queen of Canadian pop, Carly Rae Jepsen. It's BC Unidos with Trouble in the Streets.
That was BC Unidos with Trouble in the Streets. This is the Monocle Weekly.
Commercial pilot Lode Odjinran flies planes full of passengers every day, but since he was a boy, he's always wanted to fly a plane solo around the world.
Now, flying a light plane any kind of long distance is something of a logistical challenge. You need some of the obvious things organised, like, Rob, having enough fuel.
Yep.
But you also need clearance to land, to take off, and you need to make sure your host country is a friendly one. It's not an undertaking anyone should really attempt without the full support.
But that's what Lola did, and his journey hopping from country to country eventually took him 9 months. He began and ended in Washington in the United States and completed the journey earlier this year. And earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall sat down with him to learn how he did it.
Not very many people have flown around the world. In fact, more people have flown into space than actually flown around the world solo. I think around about now we're just about 117 people that have done it since 1930. But when I had this dream of flying around the world, I didn't see it on television. I didn't read it in the newspaper. I just, you know, I used to stare up at aeroplanes and wondered what it would look like or feel like, actually, to fly around the world. And as I grew older, I never could get it off my mind, and it just became so hard to do. And the harder it got, the more determined I became. So,
and you're a commercial pilot by
yes,
trade. So,
yes.
I mean, you know, you achieved that goal of taking to the skies, but you always had this sort of other aim that you wanted to do of flying solo in a plane on your own.
Absolutely.
Around the world. But it didn't happen in a conventional way. I think a lot of people assume that, you know, we're talking maybe a couple of weeks journey or something like that.
Yes.
But it took you 9 months.
Yes,
it did. And quite a lot of that was to do with quite a hard slog through bureaucracy and the realities of trying to do it on your own, because you didn't do it with backing. Tell us a little bit about what that 9 month journey encapsulated.
It was very unconventional, like you've rightfully said, and your average round the world flight would take between 6 to 9 weeks. Mine took about 9 months for very many reasons. So for example, on the very, very first flight, I had to go on GoFundMe to raise the fuel money. Now, you could say that's brave or you could say that's dumb. You know, I don't know what to call it, but it just shows that, you know, it's all about belief and the tenacity to always never give up, which was why it ended up being 9 months. I was accused of being a spy.
Yeah, I mean, tell me about that. What happened there?
Well, I am obviously black, Nigerian, I'm British, and I was flying an American airplane. And I think flying around the world and being an adventurer isn't very, blacks are not known for adventure that much. So it just didn't add up, you know. So it was like everywhere I went to, my passport was examined and re-examined, and my face was like, okay, what's going on? What are you doing? Flying around the world? For what? What are you spying on? What are you looking for? So I had to do a lot of convincing. And thanks to Google, there was one particular place I got stuck in. I said, guys, please just Google me. And once people know what you're about, generally you don't have a problem. They'll let you go.
Yeah, I mean, you're sort of, you're putting a sort of happy face on that. But yes. I mean, there is a sort of very real issue of discrimination there, isn't there? I mean,
well,
what was it? What kind of day-to-day, you know, entanglements were you finding yourself in?
You know, this is what the challenges is all about. Being the first has a lot of price attached to it. Now, someone said to me, I couldn't believe that a Nigerian or someone from Nigerian background would actually do something like this. And to me, that meant a lot, because my son would grow up now looking at anything he wants to do, so be it, like, you know, whatever he thinks of, like not being a real deal, because I've shown that you could achieve whatever you set to. England is a free country. It's a land of opportunities. And this is what we're demonstrating, that someone like Lola can come to England at a very young age. I was born in England, left, came back again, and chased his dream. So I think this is exactly what the trip was trying to demonstrate, that sky isn't the limit anymore, actually. You could do whatever you choose to do.
Yeah. And talk us through, I mean, you might see it as sort of a quite boring question, but I think people who don't fly much would be interested. I mean, you mentioned there that maybe a, you know, fully sponsored, massively supported flight around the world might take up to 9 weeks.
Yes.
That's something that I'm trying to compute in my brain, because obviously a plane can, say, get to Australia or so in 24 hours. So what's the logistics there? What's stopping a solo flight from progressing?
First and foremost, to fly around the world in a light aircraft.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking of an aeroplane that weighs half the size of a family car.
Right.
Is a lot different than flying to Australia in a jumbo in all aspects, price, in weight and everything. So yes, you are right. Australia is about 24 hours away from London, but it would take me about 2 weeks, 3 weeks to get to Australia from London.
And that's because
The speed of the airplane is a lot different.
Yeah.
I cannot fly as high. I'm subjected to a lot of weather.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things. So it's actually being able to fly in that little tiny thing that's remarkable, because these things are designed to fly for 4 hours max.
Yeah.
And when I was flying it, I flew on one particular leg 14 and a half hours.
Yeah.
So that's the remarkable side of things.
So it's almost a challenge, as well as the aviation one and the skill and the navigation. It's also just a purely a logistics challenge.
Logistic.
Yeah, organizing your accommodation at the end of every flight.
And, absolutely.
And, you know, do you have to get clearance to be able to land in?
Yes, before you fly to any country or over any country, you have to get clearances and they have to approve that. So some of it takes about a week, some takes 2 weeks, and some takes hours.
Yeah.
And that's where having an American registered aeroplane came to help.
Yeah.
That's where holding a British passport actually helps, because you don't realize how powerful that passport is until you start going around the world.
Yeah.
So, yes, it does help having those two things, the American registered or British registered aeroplane,
yeah,
and indeed a British passport.
And, I mean, obviously we could talk about the route for a very, very long time, but we only have a certain amount of time. But tell us briefly, what was the route you took and what were the stops? What were the countries that you found?
Okay, so five continents. So started from Washington, D.C., flew into Canada via JFK, and then from Canada, Goose Bay, I flew all the way to Iceland. That was about 11 hours. From Iceland to Scotland, from Scotland to England, from England to Valencia, from Valencia to Malta, from Malta to Egypt. Then from Egypt, I flew into Djibouti in Africa. From Djibouti, I flew into Oman, Pakistan. And then from Pakistan, I flew into Bangladesh, Thailand. And that was where I met everything. I met Jesus in Thailand. I met the monsoon. And it took me about almost 4 weeks to go through Thailand to Darwin in Australia.
Oh, wow.
The worst of the weather was waiting for me there.
And this whole trip, as we mentioned before, I mean, it took 9 months.
Yes.
But tell me, were you en route that whole time, or did you find yourself landing the plane and flying back to the UK for a while?
Right. You know, so whenever I got the airplane broke down or was weather delays or anything, and I've had it up to there, I'd leave the aeroplane in a secured place.
Yeah.
I run back to work,
yeah,
do a couple of weeks at work, and then when the weather settles down, or indeed when I've made a bit more money, I run back to the aeroplane. So I actually spent a lot more than had I done it in one go.
Yeah.
So all in all, I took three major breaks, lasting for about a month to about 6 weeks, 7 weeks. Yeah.
And as you say, you work as a commercial pilot, and I understand that area of your work actually played in your fortune, because am I right, it brought you into contact with Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden. Correct?
Yeah.
And he helped you out?
Yes.
What did Bruce do? Because he's a pilot as well. He sometimes flies the whole band, doesn't he?
Yeah, great guy. Bruce is an absolute genius. You're going to be taken aback when you meet Bruce. He's like an average day-to-day guy. And the very second he heard, he was like, are you that guy flying around the world? I've seen your face. I'm like, because I actually got scared that he was going to say to me, oh, no, we don't want adventurous pilots here. You can go and carry on your duty. That's it. And he goes, so where are you at? I said, my aircraft is in London. He said, so what's the problem? I said, I'm stuck. He goes, how much do you need? I said, I need X amount. He said, okay, we can work something out. And no jokes. That was it. Because I was getting to that point where I was starting to give up.
Yeah.
I had two major sponsors before then. Got the aeroplane, got halfway, and then got stuck again. And it was just so difficult. And then when Bruce came along, that was it. So sometimes you do need pilots. People like him, who was a pilot, can relate to what I was going through.
I was
going to
make a terrible joke about friends in high places.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He flies a plane, you get,
absolutely,
get it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you're not stopping here. You've got a new project on the go.
Where
I understand you're trying to, well, maybe you can talk me through it, but it's about flying at extremely high altitude.
Yes. Right? So currently, the highest a light single-engine aircraft has flown is about 56,000 feet. I'm trying to break that record. I'm trying to get up to 60,000 feet. And I was at the BBC a couple of weeks ago, and the BBC were very kind. And I've gotten in touch with NASA.
Oh, cool.
And NASA hopefully will be giving me a suit to wear because of the properties of the air, the density, the temperature, the pressure and everything. I have to go in a pressure suit. So I had my aviation medical a few days ago, and I've lost about 6 kilos, and I keep losing weight as well because I have to be at a certain weight for that.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest challenge, actually.
Well, we wish you all the best with all the future challenges, and congratulations on your journey around the world as well.
Thank you.
Lola, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
That was the pilot, Lola Odejinrin, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall a little earlier. Photographer Jim Herrington is a keen climber, but when he's not scurrying up rock faces, he's known for having photographed some of the arts world's most distinctive figures, from the Rolling Stones to Morgan Freeman to Dolly Parton.
But his new book, The Climbers, turns his lens on the less well-known faces who have achieved equally impressive feats out amongst the great outdoors. And he joins us now to talk about it. Jim, welcome to the programme. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for being here.
When we were looking through your book before the interview here, there are so many great craggy faces in it. But this is all about the pre-Gore-Tex, before all that.
That's so a good way to put it. I wish I could think of something that's succinct. As I've been in these interviews and talking to people, I've kind of discovered that the musicians, which I photographed as well from these earlier eras, the rock and roll, not unlike each other. You know, they were on the fringes of society. I mean, now, you know, people's grandmothers climb at the climbing wall, but these guys were certainly on the fringes of things, as the rock and rollers were. But yes, pre-Gore-Tex, Triconi nail boots, ropes that broke if you fell on them.
This has been a sort of 20-year opus in the making of a lot of you, maybe on downtime between magazine assignments, commercial assignments, all the rest of it. This is your kind of labor of love.
Very true. Didn't mean for it to last a segment of my life, but that's the way it happened on my own dime, which was a very thin dime for many of those years. So doing it when I could. When I started, it was pre-internet, more or less. So you couldn't Google these people and find their Instagram account. Sometimes it took a while to find out if they were even alive. And then there would be handwritten letters and waiting a month or two for a reply, if you got one at all. So, you know, there was a bit of adventure in the beginning just to find these people and get to them.
And can I ask, I mean, people often talk about meeting heroes, and obviously you've already said you shot, you know, rock and roll royalty and all the rest. Did they always deliver? Because, I mean, there are some stories which are so famous, I guess, with some of these guys that people will know. Did you ever feel, I guess you never felt let down? It was always, they always had a sparkle in the
eye.
I don't
agree with that concept. I've got friends, especially in the music world, when I was shooting these people. There's a friend of mine in particular, she just said, I could never meet my heroes. What if I was disappointed? Well, disappointed in what? I mean, they're still great, because geniuses usually come with a lot of baggage, so you got to be prepared. That never bothered me, no. So,
okay,
yeah, there's been disappointing moments with people and behavior, but it doesn't disappoint me beyond just disappointment as a human, but I usually don't equate that with what greatness they've done.
Yeah. Hmm. I feel in the book there's a lot of writing in the book as well. It's worth its purchase price for your own foreword, Jim, and some of the wonderful writing in the front of it as well. But I feel like there is a sort of unwritten conversation being had between all these climbers who presumably know of each other. They know of each other's exploits. There might have been fierce competition and fallings out amongst some of these people.
Yep.
What happened when you turned up at X's house and said, oh, I photographed Y last month for this book, and they said, well, get out of town? What are some of the, not necessarily the stories that are behind the pictures, but presumably you were entering quite a small and competitive world?
Yeah, I mean, you think of London today, and, you know, there's probably 50 climbers on this block that don't know each other. Back then, you know, there were 50 climbers in the world that had heard of each other and probably climbed with each other or competed for a route. There would have been some run-ins, some wonderful partnerships, and yeah, people racing to beat each other to routes.
Yeah.
Certainly. It was a small world of climbing back then.
Jim, I wanted to ask you, and obviously the cover image is entirely arresting, these amazing eyes. I mean, Rob said earlier, these sort of expressive faces, but weathered, literally weathered features. These must be amongst the most delightful faces to photograph. In a way, is it kind of easy to capture the stories because there's these crease lines, you can see what these people have been through? Tell us a bit about how, I don't know, maybe how that compares to rock and roll weathering. Is it a different category?
I have to be honest, I don't really go for the weathered face cliche. You know, there's a lot of people that like the old men with the wrinkles. I'm more after the stories and the era of these people. They happen to be old and, you know, they do look interesting, but some people get very excited about the wrinkly old faces. Mm. I'm more after the story behind it that probably caused those wrinkles. Photographically speaking, yeah, I guess they're interesting.
Those are as youthful
cute
and sparkly,
old men
sparkling eyes as you could find, yeah. Right? I mean, there's nothing old about the aspect of that face, I guess.
Well, that was Bradford Washburn, who was explored the Alaska Range in the 30s and 40s. But he was also this great aerial photographer who shot 8x10 roll film of mountain ranges. And his photographs were so beautiful and sharp that people used them for decades to plan future first ascents. So I did kind of want to shoot his face like one of his mountain photographs. Another interesting thing about him, he was invited to be on the round-the-world flight with Amelia Earhart. And he said, well, there's this one little part of the Pacific where there's no radio contact. I'm an inventor. I can put a little radio relay on one of these atolls, patch us up. And they said, nah. And that's where she went down.
I like in the beginning of your book, in the foreword, Jim, you talk about some of the turning up to places, catching Greyhound buses and all the rest of it. Some of them sort of romantic ways of getting around a big country like the United States and opening a bottle of something and getting these guys to tell you some stories. Was that a sort of classic icebreaker? Because when you turn up to someone's house, how do you get those stories flowing? Do you get the camera out first or do you open the bottle first?
Well, that's the thing. You know, I don't have a lot of producers and people pre-interviewing. I am a lot of times showing up off of a bus, not just America, Europe, and everywhere else. Sometimes these people don't speak English and I don't speak their language. It's a delicate thing to kind of wander into someone's house in some high alpine village with a camera. So especially if, like Ricardo Cassin, he's literally dying in front of you and the family's there holding a vigil. You know, you don't want to just come in all photo shooty.
Yeah.
You know, holding up your croppers. It's interesting.
That portrait of Ricardo Cassin in your book is absolutely phenomenal. It looks like a man who is possibly staring his last mountain in the face.
Well, he died 7 days after I left. And literally, they were having a vigil. His great-great-great-grandkids, they were prepared for it. But most climbers have a pretty impressive library. You know, they were influenced by people before them, and they got it. For the most part, they knew what I was doing, and I think some of them had to be convinced to do it, but I think most of them realized it was worth doing for them.
You didn't turn up to a high alpine village on your own after taking 3 flights and 4 buses, and you weren't told to sod off by any particular unbecoming Austrians or Frenchmen, were you?
No, I did have 2 rejects, not after all that effort, but really good rejects, though.
Really good rejects.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jim, I want to ask you a bit about we started by talking about the sort of vaingloriousness of climbing, the dream, and sometimes these people have been kind of outliers from society, so obsessed with their pursuit. We talk about how climbing's gone sort of professional and there is that gloss and glamour and it's hard to kind of go off the radar now. Do you think the dream of today's climbers, are their dreams the same as this generation? Or is there still that kind of purity? Does it actually... Once you're, you know, out on the mountain, it's different and it doesn't matter whether you've got a sponsor's name on your back or if other people know about what you're doing. The ultimate, that dream, that obsessive pursuit, is that still the same?
I think it is for people climbing in the Himalaya and doing really difficult routes in Patagonia and these really isolated places. Very different than these purely athletic gym climbers who climb indoors most of their life or doing sport. Very safely protected sport crag routes. But yeah, you get someone doing an unclimbed North Face somewhere in Western China on a high altitude peak.
And it could be these guys.
It could be the 20s. It could be the 1200s, you know, because it's rock and snow and sun and storm.
And that is the sort of the connoisseurship that you're trying to capture in a lot of these portraits. The connoisseurship of not necessarily a dying art. Maybe it is a dying art. The danger, or you've just described to us a sort of craggy face in Western China, something unknowable. Is the art of it changing, I wonder?
It is and it isn't. You know, I met a lot of these pre-war climbers in Italy and France, and they didn't have a lot of opportunity in any direction. It's funny, nowadays we talk about a weekend climber, and that's sort of an amateur. No, I'm just a weekend climber.
Yeah.
You know, not very serious. These guys... worked in a factory all week and would get off at 6 p.m., probably didn't have enough money to own a bike, would borrow a bike, ride 40 kilometers up into the Dolomites, do a classic first ascent, which is still incredible test piece today, bike back and be at work on a Monday morning. They were weekend climbers.
Yeah, right.
You know, there was no Instagram. There was no media attention at all. It was very much for the sake of doing it and improving it amongst your tight group of peers. You know, the sense of exploration, I think, is a lot different now because we've seen every top and bottom and inside of everything on planet Earth. Yeah, and these people lining up for Everest, you know, there's 200 people in a row to get up the same route.
There's litter all the way up and all this kind of thing.
You know, you think of Hillary and even the guys before him, it is almost worth dying for. It's a place that humans haven't been. There is something noble about that. To be the 4,000th person to go up the South Coal route, standing in line, and still not really under your own steam. You've got a guide. You've paid a ton of money. It's a different kind of thing these days.
Are there other sort of boundary pushes that you'd be interested to shoot in the future?
Outside of climbing?
Outside of climbing, perhaps.
I've been trying to think of this. I need to get this music book out of my life and out of my closet, which is 35-plus years. I've been thinking about who else would I get? What is the new interesting thing? I tend to always be attracted to old everything, whatever I'm into, music, photography, Italian cooking. It would be interesting for me to find something current.
Chefs on the edge.
That's happening, yeah. And maybe they're going to Mars. I don't know. I need to think about this.
Well, let's end on the music thing, Jim. I'm glad you handily pointed us in that direction. That's 35 years in the making. An old man compared to the mere 20 that went into climbers. How on earth do you know when a book like that is finished?
Because I'm tired of doing it. And, most of my heroes have died. That's what I was always chasing down. You know, my dad was into Benny Goodman.
Yeah.
And I heard Benny Goodman when I was a fetus. And I photographed him when I was 13. And that was kind of the beginning of the music thing. And I just got deep into American music, jazz, country, blues, soul, all that stuff. And, you know, besides the commercial work, which I did kind of sway over to my way of thinking, but it was always seeking out these musical legends to photograph them, loosely putting this book together through the years. And I'm 54. I'm ready for a new project. I always joke about maybe it's time for the flower era, where I do the still life of flowers.
Yeah, know? Right. And do you approach a climber as you approach a Rolling Stone? I mean, is there some similarity in that? Because you've got people that have hidden their light under a bushel, and it's a book that can be enjoyed by the uninitiated, whereas people will obviously know a lot of the faces in your music book. Is it the same conversation? Is it the same opening of the bottle? Is it the same ginger sort of uncapping of the lens cap that starts both those conversations, or are they different?
Well, for one thing, I know a lot about both of these worlds, music and climbing. You know, I know some photographers who are just doing it as a living, and they kind of walk into these worlds and they don't have much to talk to with the people. You know, I can go to Willie Nelson and we can sit there and talk about Roger Miller records all day long, or Django Reinhardt, and I don't have to talk about Willie. You know, a lot of these people, when I was a kid, they just seemed like-minded folks. There was nobody around that I knew when I was a kid that was into any of the stuff I was into. But I would see these people in the magazine. Ooh, Willie likes Django? So do I. He might be my friend one day. Who else am I going to talk about Django Reinhardt with? You touched on a couple things there. I didn't want all famous faces in this book or in the music. You know, there's a lot of these journeyman types that are really good but never quite got the name or ended up in the history book. So I was very conscious with the music and the climbers to represent these under-the-radar people. And the book's got a lot of, for every Reinhold Messner, there's a Don Clonch Gordon.
How do you, and just finally, Jim, how do you square it when you're photographing someone like Dolly Parton and you say, oh, I'm also working on a book about climbers? Do those worlds meet? Do the people that you shoot for either project understand the other one?
Interestingly enough, I've been getting more positive interest out of the climber book from non-climbers. I've been getting more book nerds, photography geeks, you know, art people interested in the book. There's interested people wherever you go. You know, Dolly might be interested, but Willie Nelson might not be. You never know.
Thank you, Jim. And The Climbers is available now, and we heartily recommend you get hold of a copy. You are still listening to The Monocle Weekly. There you have it, Tom. 4-3-8 down of The Monocle Weekly.
Indeed. And there was certainly raw poetry in the programme, not the least of it from the beautiful images of Jim Harrington. I know you mentioned that people should get hold of a copy. That is a sumptuous and delightful work. Yeah. And the figures depicted are inspirations. Every one of those faces tells an extraordinary story.
What a cool dude as well.
Yeah. Right? We've summited the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks also to Anu Partanen. She was wise, wasn't she, indeed?
And not forgetting Lola, of course, Rob, with his extraordinary solo feats.
Amazing stuff, isn't it? Shall we thank our pals behind the glass?
Let's do it.
Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Alessio Del Anna, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. The Monocle Weekly will be back, same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thank you for tuning in.